Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. My guest this half hour, independent U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont, of course, the 2016 Democratic presidential candidate. He won 23 states, over 13 million votes in that primary, ultimately losing to Hillary Clinton. Lost the Iowa caucuses, if you remember, to Hillary Clinton by less than one percentage point. He's out with a new book, Bernie Sanders' Guide to Political Revolution. Tonight, he is speaking at the New Hampshire Auditorium in Iowa City, presented by Prairie Lights Bookstore. Incidentally, a sold-out event. It's been sold out for quite some time. Senator Sanders joins me in our Iowa City studio. Welcome.
Nice to be with you, Ben.
Even though we have a shortened amount of time here, reach out to our listeners if you'd like to join us with a question for Senator Sanders. 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. We do have listener questions sent in previously via Facebook. But let me ask you, first of all, we've been hearing the news, Senator Sanders, you just flew in to Iowa moments ago. We're hearing about the disaster in Texas as the floodwaters recede, the enormity of the damage becoming apparent. What's your take on it, and especially our federal government's response to it, the president's response to it?
Well, the response of the American people to it is that when we see the suffering and the dislocation and the deaths and the many, many thousands of people who are homeless, this is one nation. And our job as an American people, as a government, is the need to respond to that crisis. And I expect that the Congress will. One of the concerns that I've had since Trump has been president is his desire to divide us up, you know, by race, by religion, by our sexual orientation, by the country that we came from. And I think what you're seeing in Houston today is that people, whether they're black or white or Latino, whatever they are, they're coming to aid each other, which is what this country is supposed to be about. So, Ben, I think what the people of Vermont want, the people of Iowa want, is to stand with the people of Texas, just as if there's an emergency in Texas or emergency in Iowa, we expect the people of Texas to stand with us. That's what being a nation is about.
Briefly, tell us, what do you want to drive home tonight to your Iowa audience, your message as connected with your new book, Guide to Political Revolution?
Well, the message is that in many respects, and very, to me, very troubling, the United States of America is moving toward an oligarchic society. And I know that's not something that media talks about or politicians talk about, but that's what I think is happening.
Tell us what you mean by oligarchic.
What I mean by that is that we are seeing a small number of very wealthy people, multi-billionaires, who have incredible control over our economic life and our political life. And politically, what it means is that as a result of this disastrous Supreme Court decision on Citizens United, the billionaire class, people like the Koch brothers and others, are able to contribute unlimited sums of money into the political process, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars every year coming from a handful of billionaires. To my mind, what democracy is supposed to be about and what this country is supposed to be about is one person, one vote. Everybody has a voice in determining the future of this country. We disagree with each other, but it's one person, one vote. But what we have evolved to now is a political system in which a handful of billionaires really dictate policy. And I can give you example after example about how Congress ignores the needs of the American people, does exactly the opposite of what the American people want because of the campaign contributions and the power of very wealthy individuals.
Jerry and Swisher emailing us. He writes, I have been an independent voter most of my life, but I registered as a Democrat last election in order to support you. He's talking to you, Bernie Sanders. My concern is how and whether the Democratic Party can reform itself with special interests and big money still entrenched to reconnect with so many of the voters it lost last time. To finish up what Jerry and Swisher has to say, I really don't see a concerted effort to accomplish that. Do you see that happening? And if so, how do you think it can be done? And if not, will you support a third party?
Well, Jerry Ann, that's exactly what I run around the country talking about. And the need is to bring about the transformation of the Democratic Party, which for too many years has been dependent on corporate money, on the money of the wealthy, and to make it into a grassroots party of working people, of young people, who are prepared to take on the big money interests and fight for the needs of ordinary Americans. And in this book that I just wrote, we talk about what that is about. What is a progressive agenda? What do we need to do in this country? And among other things, we do not need to do what Trump is now talking about, is giving the wealthiest people in this country more tax breaks, giving large corporations that in some cases make billions of dollars a year in profit. They don't need any tax breaks when some of them are paying nothing in taxes right now. We need to raise the minimum wage to a living wage. We need to rebuild our crumbling infrastructure. You know, you talk about what's going on in Houston. And obviously the immediate concern is to save lives, to rescue people, to make sure that people are living with a bit of dignity now as it, when they've lost their homes. But longer term, we have to take a look at the role that climate change has probably played on that disaster. Infrastructure. Our infrastructure all over this country is crumbling. Roads, bridges, water systems, levees, dams, airports. We can create up to 15 million jobs by investing $1 trillion in infrastructure. So what we need, to answer Jerry Ann's good question, is to bring our people together to stop the divisions in this country that Trump is promoting and to focus on a progressive agenda that stands for the needs of working people.
Bernie Sanders with us live for this first half hour. Let's go to a caller. Carrie is in Iowa City. Hi, Carrie. Please be brief with your question for Bernie Sanders. A big welcome to you, though.
Thanks, and welcome back to Iowa City, Senator Sanders. I was a big supporter of yours. My question is, I just wanted to get your perspective on tax reform. I recently had read a book called A Fine Mess by T.R. Reid that lays out sort of an agenda for broad-based lowering the rates and then a value-added tax, and I just wanted to know your thoughts. Thanks.
I'm not a great fan, Kerry, for sales tax increases because they're fairly regressive. When I look at taxation, what I look at is a nation today which has massive levels of income and wealth inequality, where the top 0.1% now owns almost as much wealth as the bottom 90%, where 52% of all new income today is going to the top 1%, where in fact the very wealthiest people are doing phenomenally well while the middle class is shrinking, and at the same time we have 43 million people living in poverty. So what tax reform to me means is asking the wealthiest people in this country to start paying their fair share of taxes. It means eliminating loopholes. It means raising the highest tax rate, marginal rate. It means doing away with a lot of corporate loopholes that enable multi-billion-dollar corporations who are making just huge profits, who are now stashing their profits in the Cayman Islands or Bermuda, in some cases not paying a nickel in federal income tax. So tax reform means to me that we are living in the wealthiest country in the history of the world and that we have to ask large profitable corporations and the wealthiest people to begin paying their fair share of taxes so we can reinvest in America and do the things that we have to do.
Senator Sanders, let's pivot quickly to health care. News came out yesterday that Democratic Senator from California, Kamala Harris, will co-sponsor your single-payer health care bill to be introduced this month, according to reports. Tell us briefly, what are you introducing?
Well, thanks, Ben. You know, when we talk about a progressive agenda, when we talk about speaking to the needs of working people, when we talk about taking on special and powerful interest, we're talking about health care reform. Now, in my view, health care is a right of all people, and it's not just a privilege. We're all going to get sick. We're all going to need health care. And in my view, whether you're rich or poor, you should have access to the highest quality health care that the system can offer. And this is not a radical idea. And I hope people and listeners know that we are the only major country on earth not to guarantee health care to all people as a right. Every other major country does it. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, did you want to?
No, I just wanted to jump in. What tells you this is the moment for single payer? We have polls. I have the Pew Research saying that, public opinion is climbing in favor of a single payer approach, but still only roughly a third of Americans, according to polls.
There are different polls that they say different things. There's another poll that came out that 60 said recently, I think a credible poll that said 60% of the American people feel that the federal government should, in fact, guarantee health care to every man, woman, and child. Why do I feel this way? I think because the business community is beginning to look at our health care system and saying, why is it that we are spending per capita almost twice as much as the people of every other country? And I think that to answer your question, I think the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare, has done a lot of good things. 20 million more people have insurance. We've dealt with the obscenity of pre-existing conditions. We've dealt with the problem of insurance companies having limits on what they could help people with chronic illnesses. But the time is now, and I think more and more people see it, that we have a system in which deductibles are too high, co-payments are too high, premiums are too high. 28 million people have no health insurance. We need to guarantee health care to all people, and the most cost-effective way to do that is to expand Medicare to every man, woman, and child.
Briefly before we go to the call, but of course we know Republicans control Congress and the White House. How do you get it done in this political
atmosphere? You're not going to get it done. You're not going to get it done while we have a right-wing president and a right-wing House and a right-wing Senate. And that speaks to what this book is about, what I try to do, and that is making a political revolution. I think if you ask most people in America, should health care be a right? The answer is yes. Are we spending too much? We're spending now, Ben, $10,000 a person on healthcare. That's unsustainable. And the reason for that is we have a healthcare system whose function is not to provide quality care to all in a cost-effective way. It is to make huge profits for the insurance companies, the drug companies, medical equipment suppliers. One out of five Americans under the age of 64 can't afford the medicine that their doctors prescribe because the cost of prescription drugs in this country is outrageously high, far and away the highest in the world. Meanwhile, five pharmaceutical companies made $50 billion in profit last year. That's insane. That's wrong. And that's why we need a Medicare for all, single-payer approach, which will negotiate prices with the drug companies, be far more efficient than the dysfunctional system we have today.
Bernie Sanders with us live. Bernie Sanders' Guide to Political Revolution just out. He's speaking tonight in Iowa City at a sold-out Hampshire auditorium. We have just a few minutes left with Senator Sanders. Of course, any of these topics we could talk about at length. We have not that much time. Let's go to Janet in the Quad Cities. Hi, Janet. We're just a few more minutes left with Bernie Sanders. Please be brief and ask your question.
Hi, Ben. Thank you for taking me.
Sure thing.
Senator Sanders, I was a strong supporter, listened to you twice, contributed, bought $700, and I was a part of the DNC lawsuit, the fraud lawsuit against the Democratic National Convention, which is represented by Jared and Elizabeth Beck, also Sanders supporters. I would like your comment on that. We have felt disenfranchised from our system and to see the shenanigans that went on during the primary.
Well, look, Janet, it is no great secret that we had to take on in that campaign the entire establishment. That includes the DNC, that includes almost every United States senator who is a Democrat, every governor, almost all the Democratic members of the House of Representatives. We took on the establishment. And Janet, thank you so much for your support. Here in Iowa, we did infinitely better than people thought we would. We came within a whisker of winning the caucus here. We then went on to New Hampshire, where we won, I think, by 20 points in New Hampshire. We ended up winning 22, 23 states. And it all started here, by the way, in the state of Iowa. But I think what we have got to do now is look forward and not backwards. And that what we need to do is continue the political revolution, which is happening all over the country. More and more people getting involved, running for school board, running for state legislature, running for the Congress. And You know, that's what I'm looking at.
To follow up on Janet's point, though, in the current time, currently, there's a class action lawsuit alleging that the Democratic National Committee worked in conjunction with Hillary's campaign to keep you out of the White House. In brief, the attorneys in this lawsuit say that they violated their own charter, the DNC, with a single campaign, working with a single campaign to effectively choose who would win it, Hillary Clinton.
That is
do you agree with the claim that they're making?
What I agree with is we took on the establishment. And did the DNC support Hillary Clinton? That is no great secret. They did. But the point right now is, with Donald Trump as president, with right-wing extremists controlling the U.S. House and the U.S. Senate, our job is to mobilize people and move forward. And what we're seeing all over this country is young people, working people, coming into the Democratic Party, winning positions at virtually all levels. And to my mind, that's what we've got to focus on.
Mm-hmm. According to data from the Cooperative Congressional Election Study, this was a study of a survey of around 50,000 people. Fully 12% of the people who voted for you, Bernie Sanders, in 2016 in the Democratic primaries ended up voting for President Trump in the general election. How do you explain that?
What do you mean? How do I explain?
People how do vote. You, how do you explain?
People vote for whomever they want to vote. My understanding is that in 2008, something like 24% of the people who voted for Hillary Clinton voted for John McCain. I don't, you know, people raise this issue and the media talks about it a whole lot. I don't know who you vote for. I don't know who you vote for in the primary and what your reasons are.
Doesn't that tell you there's an overlap in the vision? If some people could see you as the first choice and Donald Trump as the second choice?
Well, what it tells me, and this is nothing new, is that, you know, Donald Trump lied a whole lot during his campaign. He told the American people, the people of Iowa, the people of Vermont, that he was going to take on the establishment. He was going to drain the swamp. He was going to lower prescription drug costs. He was going to provide health care to everybody. That's what he said. Well, unfortunately, he lied. But there were a lot of people who were very disillusioned with the Democratic Party for good reason. And they said, okay, Trump says he's anti-establishment. Maybe I don't like him from a personality point of view or a vulgarity point of view. But you know what? I'm going to vote for him over Hillary Clinton. And that obviously happened. But the idea that, you know, somebody voted for me in a primary and Trump in the general election, I don't think that's all that shocking.
You're on a very busy schedule, Senator Sanders. We thank you for your time. We have a couple minutes left before you have to depart the studio here in Iowa City. Amanda Crystal, one of our listeners, asks, an independent with good voting, a good-sized voting base, she writes, how do you see that you're using that support in the 2018 midterms?
Well, what we are doing right now is we're supporting strong candidates all across this country, people running for literally from school board to the United States Congress. And one of the very exciting aspects of what happened during the campaign is that after the campaign, a new group was formed. It's called Our Revolution. And Our Revolution, their reason for existence is to provide the tools and the support that new people need or progressive candidates need in order to win elections. They've been doing a very, very good job in elections all across this country. So I think the result of the campaign, one of the results of the campaign, is not only that the issues that we talked about, and that is Medicare for all, demanding that the wealthy stop paying their fair share of taxes, rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, making public colleges and universities tuition-free, raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. Those ideas that we talked about in the campaign are now kind of mainstream ideas. But more importantly, what you see now is a whole lot of energy among younger people and working people who are now getting involved in the political process in a way that we have not seen for a long time.
One last question. I see your people are waiting to get you to your next event in Iowa City. Of course, following on 2018 will be 2020. You've been asked this question many times, but you're in Iowa now. In 2017, are you considering a run in 2020?
No, as I have said many times, I mean, I think we should not be worrying. It's really been, honestly, much too early to be talking about that. What we have got to be talking about are the issues facing the American people. I work very, very hard, among other things, and among other people, to defeat this disastrous Republican proposal, which would have thrown 32 million people off of the health care that they have. We're working hard now trying to create a climate and national support for a Medicare for all system. We're going to work very hard to make sure that Trump is not successful giving tax breaks to billionaires. That's what the focus has got to be on. Mm-hmm. The idea that we never, you know, we keep, you know, in the United Kingdom, they have elections in a two-month period. I know the media would be very disappointed in that. Canada, pretty much the same thing. We never stop talking about these things. And I think the American
Especially in Iowa.
Well, I know, but the American people—
And Vermont.
You know, the American people, I think, would like us to focus on the real issues impacting their lives, not about personalities who might or might not run for president.
Bernie Sanders, U.S. Senator from Vermont, thank you very much for your time, sir.
And, thank you.
Thank you for making time for us during your visit in Iowa. I'll mention again, Bernie Sanders' Guide to Political Revolution, his new book out. He'll be speaking tonight at the New Hampshire Auditorium in Iowa City, presented by Prairie Lights Bookstore. And thank you for all the listener questions. Of course, we didn't get to close to half of your questions. Many questions went unanswered, but thank you for chipping those in. I want to go now to our political analyst. Rachel Caulfield is with us. Hi, Rachel.
Hi.
Joining us in our Des Moines studio, Associate Professor of Political Science at Drake University. You've been listening along here. I'd like to have you sort of pick apart any of the things that you heard Bernie Sanders say, highlight in his guide to a political revolution. What caught your ear in particular?
Well, I think for the most part, those of us in Iowa who have had a chance to get to know Bernie Sanders over the course of the 2015-16 campaign cycle, this is a lot of the same messaging that we've heard. Of course, the key is that he went on after Iowa to build a more nationwide movement. And so these ideas, as he notes, you know, they're much more popular today. They're getting more attention outside of his, you know, his immediate support base that we saw in Iowa. And I appreciated the question about, you know, what about those people who voted for you in the primary and then went ahead and voted for Donald Trump? And I think, you know, to some extent, his answer hit the nail on the head, which is, you know, there is a group of people out there who are searching for something outside of our current political climate, our current political system. And
the anti-establishment vote.
Yes, the anti-candidate, if you will, right?
I mean, blow up Washington.
Yeah, and in some sense, this was the same, you know, the same sentiment behind some of Ron Paul's support once upon a time, right? Mm-hmm. This idea you not only have someone who's kind of running as an outsider who challenges the establishment within their party, but they challenge the way we practice politics. You know, once upon a time, I went to a Ron Paul rally, and my first response coming out of it was, who would have guessed that Ron Paul, of all people, right? I mean, you go listen to him. He doesn't speak like a politician. He doesn't look like a politician. He's totally outside of the box. And I think Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump both tapped into that, something new and refreshing.
Okay. We'll keep that in mind and welcome you back in our second half hour in just a moment. Rachel Caulfield in our Des Moines studio, Associate Professor of Political Science at Drake University. We're so glad to have her as a regular political analyst here. And when we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Rachel. We'd like to have you chime in as well. Bernie Sanders is gone. He's in Iowa today. But what about Bernie Sanders' vision? Do you agree with or disagree with or have questions about? I want to ask Rachel some of those very questions, particularly about the single-payer health care bill that he is introducing coming up later this month, evidently. Rachel Caulfield, stay put. We'll be back with you, okay? It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. While I have political junkies' ears, we had Senator Sanders on the first half hour, so I assume many of those ears are still hanging around for the second half hour. Let me mention that another edition of Pints and Politics tonight, an event you can attend at the Cedar Ridge Winery and Distillery in eastern Iowa in Swisher, just off of 380, presented by Iowa Public Radio and the Gazette. I'll be there. Co-moderating with investigative reporter Aaron Jordan, also political reporter James Lynch, along with columnists Linda Waddington and Todd Dorman of the Gazette. Another edition of Pints and Politics tonight. If you don't happen to make it tonight to Swisher to see and be part of the live audience, we'll be broadcasting an edited version of that tomorrow, Friday, over the noon hour. Finishing up the hour with Rachel Caulfield, Associate Professor of Political Science at Drake University, in our Des Moines studio. We're chewing over some of the things that Senator Bernie Sanders said to us live in this past half hour. He's making a visit to Iowa today. Bernie Sanders' Guide to Political Revolution, his new book, just out. He's speaking tonight at the New Hampshire Auditorium and talking about some ideas that he thinks the U.S. is ripe for. Tell us what you think of Bernie Sanders' ideas as we explore that with Rachel this hour. His vision, is it right for America, or do you think it's all wrong? 1-866-780-9100. I say that, Rachel, because one of the so many questions we didn't get to was Zachary emailing in, Senator Sanders, what do you say to critics of democratic socialism who cite Venezuela and other socialist-leaning nations as that are in disarray as reasoning democratic socialism is not being viable? So that was a question here, too. We had several questions on our Facebook page, Rachel. Perhaps you can tell us, what is the difference between the Democratic Party, the Socialist Party? We had another question between democratic socialism and communism. What? Can you give us, in a nutshell, pick those apart for us?
Well, I think, you know,
this is a semester-long class.
This is a semester-long class for sure. And it's contextual, right? These different phrases are kind of used in different ways in different societies and in different political systems. You know, the notion of democratic socialism in the United States tends to be a reliance on government programs coupled with representative government. So in many ways, it's not that far from the modern Democratic Party. And there's a reason that Senator Sanders caucuses with the Democratic caucus in the U.S. Congress. I do think it's kind of ironic at this point that our revolution is kind of supporting candidates, recruiting candidates based upon Bernie Sanders' platform. You know, Bernie Sanders has never really identified himself as a Democrat. He's been very public as an independent senator. And so now we see this kind of crop of candidates coming up and largely based on his ideas and his platform. And, you know, the goal, of course, is to reshape the Democratic Party in his image, pushing it further towards what he would view as an ideal democratic socialist platform.
Rachel, Dennis in Polk City wants to chime in on this note. Dennis, as we discuss it, what is your question? You wanted to talk about democratic socialism as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't like to point to countries like Venezuela that are kind of like borderline dictatorships. But I would like to point to the Scandinavian countries. I guess the tax rate in Denmark is like 55%.
Yep.
But they have, yeah. But they're all happy. They don't have to pay for school. They don't have to pay for health care. You know, everything's taken care of, and they all have really good wages and really good jobs, and they're all real happy. They don't seem to be disgruntled or anything. So. Why couldn't we look at that model a little bit more?
Okay, Dennis, thanks. From Polk City.
And those are the models that Bernie Sanders most frequently cites when he talks about his vision for policy. I think, you know, anytime you look at these ideologies and how they're going to function in different societies, there are a lot of significant differences between the U.S. and those Scandinavian countries. You know, we're a much more diverse population. We're a much larger population. We cover much more, diversity in terms of economic outputs. We have significantly higher levels of immigration and have for many decades. The degree to which those same policy proposals could be implemented successfully in the United States is a difficult question to answer.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about health care. We talked about that with Senator.
Speaking of.
Yes. And we had the news from yesterday in a tweet, a Democratic senator from California, Kamala Harris, sponsoring Bernie Sanders' single-payer health care bill. To be introduced in September. I keep saying this month. We're not quite into September yet.
Just a couple days.
Yeah, right. But interesting, Pew Research, and the senator remarked on this, and I was going to bring it up as well. We have some Pew Research on this. 60% of respondents in the nonpartisan Pew Research poll say the federal government is responsible for ensuring health care coverage for all Americans. 39% say this is not the government's responsibility. But Interestingly, Rachel, overall, 33% of the public now favors a single-payer approach to health insurance. This is up 5 percentage points since January, up 12 percentage points if you go back to 2014. So is this the trend? Do you see this as well, Rachel?
Well, there has definitely been a trend for many, many years now towards recognizing health care as a right rather than a privilege. And this goes back, I mean, you know, you can go back to the 08 campaign and some of Barack Obama's rhetoric on it, as well as Hillary Clinton's rhetoric. So this opinion has kind of been shaped over time as we've talked more and more about the failures in our healthcare system. And so it's kind of unsurprising that those numbers keep creeping up. There is also, of course, under Obamacare, you know, if you're not paying a lot of attention to the weeds, right? You're not a policy expert. What you heard from Obama and Democrats who supported Obamacare was, this is going to fix our system. And now you look around and you say, well, that didn't do it. Right. There are still significant problems. There are a number of states now where no marketplace is available. Premiums are going up. We just learned that Maryland's premiums are expected to increase 33% this year. There are real problems with a private market based healthcare system. And so I think a lot of those people at some point are saying, look, we thought we were fixing it, and we're not. So we need to look now to what the next step might be. This seems to be a logical next step to those folks.
What did you make of, Senator Sanders, of course, really hates the question of what 2020 and Bernie Sanders have to do with each other, and he displayed that as well at this point. So he wants to talk about the issues.
Sure.
But of course, there is a calculation going on.
Of course there is.
And I wonder if you can give us your thoughts as a political analyst here. What is the calculation for Bernie Sanders? One of them has to be, he certainly has a base of support. Who knows how big that would be in 2020. Age would have to be a factor?
Age would have to be a factor, as would, I think, you know, the conversation about the lawsuit is important. To what extent is the establishment flexible enough to open up to somebody who doesn't represent the Democratic establishment? And there are a lot of people's names who are kind of being floated right now. He's got to be looking at that field and saying, okay, so to what extent do these people embrace the same positions that I do? Is there a place for me in this race? One of the things that candidates do when they come to Iowa this early in the process is they start talking to activists about those questions. And that's a very healthy part of the process. Is there a role for me? Do I have sufficient support to get through it this time? Running for president is a huge endeavor, and you got to really negotiate a lot of different personalities there. I would say I think we're going to learn a lot about how he wants to position himself in the party when we see some of the details of the single-payer healthcare bill. We say single-payer healthcare, but there are so many details that have to go into designing this plan. Everything from, how are you going to treat the private insurance market? Are you going to eliminate it and tell those 150 million people you no longer have insurance because you can't be in the private marketplace? You have to talk, you have to consider how we're going to transition into this. And, we have kind of this idea of healthcare as market driven and therefore assume that a government system would be big enough to negotiate prices downward. That's the whole goal here in terms of the fiscal outlook. The problem, of course, is that, we got 10 to 12% of the American population working in the healthcare industry in some form or another. When you start negotiating down costs, you're also negotiating down salaries.
Tax reform was a topic we talked about last half hour with Bernie Sanders, also a main topic, I believe, Chapter 2 in his new Bernie Sanders Guide to Political Revolution. Now, President Trump yesterday made his first major tax reform speech in Missouri, I believe, reiterating his long-standing call, Rachel, for slashing U.S. corporate taxes to, I think, 15% from the current 35%, bring down corporate taxes, get rid of loopholes spur the economy. And his pitch, the president's pitch there is, this will help the common person. Now get Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump together to talk about tax reform.
That would be a great conversation.
Well, they would be how many football fields apart? Not to mention not on the same page. They are not on the same planet, are they?
No, they're really not. And this has been a fundamental disagreement between the Democratic Party and the Republican Party literally for decades. The Republicans' approach typically is that if you cut earners' taxes, then in the words of Ronald Reagan, that will trickle down to the employee. Because they'll be more likely to hire more people, provide more benefits. There will be money then in those people's pockets. They can go out. They can buy things. They'll jumpstart the economy. The Democrats, on the other hand, right, have typically said, no, the way to really help average everyday working Americans is tax those corporations at a much higher rate, and then government services can help the most underprivileged within society. So essentially government is redistributing that money. So it's a fundamental difference. You see it very plainly and clearly in how Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump both talk about this issue.
Let's go back to the phones, talking about some of the ideas in Bernie Sanders' political revolution. We had Bernie Sanders on this last half hour, if you just joined us. Rachel Caulfield of Drake University, good enough to be with us to give us her thoughts on what is left of Bernie Sanders' 2016 run, what future it may have, if I can put it that way. Mary is with us in Iowa City. Hi, Mary.
Hi. You know, I'm enjoying your show, but I love everything about Bernie. And I know, I was born in 1942, so I know that we have always had this democratic socialism with us because we don't have a pure capitalistic system. But what I'm worried about is Venezuela, and you compare it to Nicaragua, and the CIA is down there. Those people, we're going to start gunboat diplomacy, and they're going to start running north. And we're going to build the wall. Thank you.
Okay. Mary in Iowa City with your thoughts. Thank you so much. Let's talk a little bit about 2018 and beyond. You've been hearing this, reading a lot of the analysis, I'm sure, that I have been reading, Rachel. We're hearing talk on the GOP side that because of the disharmony between the White House and GOP leaders, that some GOP officials considering a 2020 Republican primary challenge against Donald Trump, Ohio's Governor John Kasich. Of course, he was there in 2016, not ruled out a second run in 2020. We have a never-Trumper, Nebraska, Senator Ben Sasse. Last month, I think he, not too long ago, he was in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. With his new book.
Of course. And right. So what do you make of this talk of a primary challenge to Donald Trump?
Well,
It's very far out to begin with.
Yes, it is. Having said that, if you're contemplating a run for the presidency, you really have to start now. Mm. It really is a huge endeavor, and you got to get ready. But, typically after every presidential election, the party that loses, we say, there's going to be some real soul searching. And that party is going to sit down and have to really contemplate what their future is going to be. And we did this, after 2008. We did this after 2012. Everybody kind of agrees that the losing party has to sit down and reevaluate where they are as a political party. What's interesting about this is that you see people within the Republican Party, the winning party, saying, we want to do some soul searching.
Right.
We want to figure out how we got here.
The winning party, but the connection, the puzzle pieces between the White House and the Congress
exactly. And
the Republican puzzle are not fitting together thus far. We'll see if it happens in tax reform.
No.
Certainly not in health care.
Certainly not in health care. Tax reform is going to be, I think, a bigger project than they think that it will be. And we have, this looming Russia investigation that could go on for years. We don't know. So, you know, and now, of course, we have recovery funding for Harvey victims. So it's, you know, there's a lot that's coming down the pike. And in just the next month, we have, right, we have a debt ceiling that needs to be raised. We have a budget that needs to be approved, or a stopgap measure needs to be approved. We have disaster relief that needs to be funded. There's a lot that Congress and the president are going to have to get together on very quickly. That's the reality of the situation. I also think, you know, within the Republican Party, long before we saw bad relationships between the White House and the Congress, there, you know, there was still consternation within the party based on the fact that, you know, you had a very strong Never Trump faction that went into the Republican convention strongly opposed to Donald Trump as the nominee. This has been a fractured party from the beginning. I think what Bernie Sanders showed us in 2016 is that the Democratic Party is also fractured.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a strong left flank to the Democratic Party that is feeling ignored within the establishment of the party.
Politico had a headline this morning, Rachel. I don't know if you saw it. Here's the headline: Dems 2020 dilemma. Familiar 70-somethings versus neophyte no-names.
Yeah, that's about right.
So the familiar 70-somethings would be, I don't know if she's 70 now, but in 2020, Elizabeth Warren would be. And, of course, Bernie Sanders has already reached that milestone.
And I think we can throw Joe Biden in the mix.
the neophyte no-names, Kamala Harris.
Absolutely.
Right? California, a very appealing candidate for many. That would have gone into the calculation of her co-sponsoring Bernie Sanders' bill, would it not, on single-payer health care?
It's hard to believe that it didn't. And in fact, a lot of people who have covered the fact that she announced that she would be the co-sponsor of the bill, or a co-sponsor of the bill, have said, you know, she wants to make sure that those Bernie supporters see her credentials and view her as somebody that they could support.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, we talked about this a little bit in the last half hour, and it's not clear. It's been overshadowed a lot. We've had Bill Sexton, one of our listeners on Facebook, aimed this at Bernie Sanders, but he says he wanted more comments on the class action lawsuit against the DNC. Mm-hmm. He said, we've had plenty of press about Russia, but nothing about the DNC. Taylor Reynolds, one of our listeners, wants to know. Now, this is a class action lawsuit alleging that the DNC, in the attorneys that are claiming this lawsuit, violated its own charter, they say, by working with a single campaign to effectively choose who would win the Democratic ballot. How much does this matter? Is it clear that that happened? And how much does it matter in terms of the DNC going forward?
Well, that's kind of a complex question. I think in terms of public perception, for members of the Democratic Party, right, voters who affiliate with the Democratic Party, this is a big deal. Because I think it draws attention to divisions within the party and the fact that the National Party organization may not be looking out for the interests of every single rank and file voter within the Democratic Party. On an institutional level, you know, as a political scientist, I'm going to be very unpopular here and say that I think parties should actually be stronger in exercising this sort of discretion. I think when party organizations, you know, the one thing that differentiates a political party from any other political organization is that they recruit and run candidates for office.
Mm-hmm.
And so party organizations choose candidates. That's one of the things that they do.
And it's only, isn't it, very recently we've gotten rid of a lot of the backroom deals. We don't know how much of that element
right.
is in there, but
right.
I mean, this idea of democratically electing a nominee to a party is pretty new, isn't it?
It is pretty new. It's been a continual process of quote-unquote democratization, small d democratization, bringing more voices into the mix in terms of choosing the nominee. But, you know, this is what the 68 convention was all about, right? The fact that you had a group of particularly young energetic activists who felt as though their voice was not being recognized by the establishment.
And the 68, the chaos we had in Chicago '68, giving rise to what other than the Iowa caucuses
eventually. That's right.
Which is a centerpiece for choosing both parties and national presidential nominees. Interesting. We've come to the end of the hour, Rachel. I want to thank you for joining us on short notice. Senator Sanders had to duck out a little bit early, but we've loved your analysis. Rachel Caulfield, Associate Professor of Political Science at Drake University. We'll look forward to welcoming you to the next Politics Wednesday, Rachel. Thanks.
Thank you.
Okay. I want to remind you again tonight, for you who can't get enough of politics, I could include myself in that number, Pints and Politics, tonight, an event at the Cedar Ridge Winery and Distillery in Swisher, Iowa. That's just off 380 between Iowa City and Cedar Rapids, presented by the Gazette and Iowa Public Radio. I'd love to see you there. I'll be there with investigative journalist of the Gazette, Aaron Jordan, also James Lynch, political reporter, columnist Linda Waddington, and Todd Dorman of the Gazette. The start time is 5:30 in Swisher at the Cedar Ridge Winery and Distillery. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon. Help today also from Robbie Broad and in Des Moines. I think John Pemble helped us out. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for spending the hour with us, and we hope to hear from you again tomorrow.